Now, I don't know just how to say what I'm wanting to say. I have been spending a few hours that I had expected to use on preparation with a businessman who dropped in unexpectedly to see me. This is a man that is involved in a very grave business problem and has been unavailable for contact, whether it be attorneys or whoever. And I just prayed that if we're going to see this man, that the Lord would have to do it. And about 3 o'clock this afternoon, the phone rang, and it was this man. A man who is very familiar with Southern California, but who says that he was lost and all of a sudden found himself at the entrance to Arrowhead Springs. And he just thought that it would be good if he would stop and see if I was here. And here I am. And I just say that with just that little detail, his name is wonderful. And after all the planning that you do, and after all of the effort that you make, my burden this week is to remind you that after it's all said and done, we walk by faith. Well, I've appreciated this conference very much so far. I thought that my two sidekicks, you know, the Harvard boys, have certainly been doing very well, and obviously Howie Hendricks is out of all our class. And we were just talking up here, the miracle of it all, that we would all be assembled in one place. Isn't that something? I hope we all appreciate the wonder of it all. Quite enough of you have asked me to read this parable that I read last year, so I'm going to read it again. This is a parable. Once upon a time there was a baseball team, remarkable in many ways, and while it put in a creditable performance against the competition, it fell short of what it believed it could do. And what was remarkable was that it had more than its share of outstanding and versatile players and boasted of a highly informal way of playing the game, which they believed released the feeling of belonging and the team spirit and the good fellowship so necessary to success. It came to pass one day when the other side was up at bat that the first baseman asked to pitch the ball and burned one across the plate. And the batter swung and missed, but the umpire, instead of calling the strike, announced time out and censured the first baseman for having usurped the pitcher's responsibility. He referred to violations of several basic principles of organization of baseball in this instance and warned him that he would be disqualified if he pitched from first base again. The first baseman answered him and said, "It just so happens that I am an outstanding pitcher besides being a top-notch first baseman. Most of the men on this team can do more than one job well, and we don't stand on bureaucratic formalities around here. They stifle initiative. And when a special situation comes up, we throw the ball to the man best talented to handle that situation. And so when this particular batter stepped up to the plate, we all knew that I was better able to strike him out. Did you see him miss my first pitch? Watch him on the next one." The umpire became wroth, and he retorted, "But pitching goes with a position and not with a man. And if the man in the pitcher's box is not equal to the challenge, swap places with him between innings, but I won't have you pitching from first base." "Well, who in thunder are you?" asked the first baseman. "The voice of experience," said the umpire. "Do you know who I am? I'm the captain of this team, and I built up the club from the bush leagues to what it is, and I've played every position, and I want my men to be able to do the same. And whatever experience you happen to be the voice of is irrelevant here. We're a unique kind of a ball team. None of us limits his responsibilities to his own job description. When there is a game to be won, we all turn to and do what has to be done. That's our particular genius, and I'll stack my men against any of those other team players, player for player. Do you win many games? By that time, the rest of the team had crowded around first base, listening eagerly to the conversation. They could no longer resist getting involved. Catcher, we could have won a few more if I had known where the next ball was being pitched from. Fielder, and if I had known where to throw the ball for the next pitch. Pitcher, and if I had thrown it to third to put out a runner instead of throwing it to the boss for the next pitch. Well, these comments from his men shocked the captain. He had never heard them talk like this before. His cherished beliefs in happy family informality were apparently not shared by his men. His greatest source of pride seemed to go unappreciated. Ungrateful wretches, he thought to himself. They don't realize how fortunate they are to work in the highly informal and unrestricted atmosphere I have spent my life nurturing. Well, if they don't appreciate it, let them work for one of the other ball clubs where they stand on formality. As for me, we're going to play the game like a happy family. And they continued to do so, for as captain of the team and owner of the club, he was in a position to see that they did. For the joy of playing first base according to his talents, rather than according to the requirements of the game, he was willing, unwittingly no doubt, to limit the effectiveness of his team. A costly luxury, as it turned out, and eventually the team leveled off its career at the minor league level. It tried to break into the big time by buying some big league talent, but this didn't help, and after several years of frustration, the captain realized that he had to make a choice. One, sell the team. Two, be willing to accept a few hits in each game and possibly even some errors in exchange for building a winning major league team. How would you have chosen? That's the end of the parable. Informality. You know, when you go into a baseball stadium, it's predictable what you're going to see. It's predictable what the field is going to look like. It's predictable what every man is going to do. It's even predictable what the umpire is going to do. And one of the reasons that we like sports is for this very reason, that there's something predictable about it. When you say football, that recalls all kinds of standardized things to your mind, doesn't it? Basketball, baseball, any of these. Now, when you say Campus Crusade for Christ, it should be the same thing, shouldn't it? It should call a characteristic way of doing things to your mind. And as it is saying here, the major league aspect of an organization has to do with this matter of commitment to a standardized, normal, predictable way of doing things. And the further you go, the less informal you can be. Now, I learned a lesson this year that I want to share with you. Last summer, we had Bill Menefee standing up here, and he told us that his company had lost many, many thousands of dollars simply because he didn't pay enough to the operation of his business. And I thought to myself, well, Bill Menefee, what a stupid fellow you are. Why would anybody want to act like him? And to my chagrin, I must confess that I did the same thing this year. I bought me a $40,000 lesson. Now, what kind of education would you pay $40,000 for? And I said, Lord, do you realize that that's more than you pay for a college education? And I got it all crammed into a six-month course. And what I did was a violation of what I have been teaching all over the world as to how you manage something. And I was sitting there clucking last year at this Bill Menefee who violated some of these same basic principles, and I proved that he was right. You don't violate these principles. Now, I sure hope that you, that... How much does that add up to, Bill, between the two of us? That's an awful lot of money. You'd think that we'd learn. Well, I'll tell you what I did. I hired a fellow to manage one of my businesses, a restaurant. And he had a good job, and he was floating around this company where I was a consultant, and he approached me one time. He was an assistant to the president of a pretty big company. And I thought I knew him, and I didn't really bother to investigate too much. And I hired him on the basis of the aura that was created around this president's office that I was a consultant to. And it seemed to me that if a fellow was hanging around a president's office every time I was there, that he ought to be pretty good. And so without a lot of investigation, I hired him. And I sent him for some training to our home office. This fellow, in the meantime, quit his job, moved his furniture to our city at a lot of expense. And I sent him to the headquarters for training. And the report that I got back was that this man would not make it. Now, those people who operate this big, huge business and who operate around 30 of these businesses and handle millions and millions of dollars a year and all kinds of personnel, it didn't seem to me that they knew what they were talking about. And when I had to pit my judgment against their judgment, it seemed to me that I was the one that was right. And I ignored their recommendation. And so we got started on this brand new business. And it lost money the first month. And it lost more money the second month. And so we sent for a consultant. That cost me $1,500 to have this fellow tell me that they didn't think that the fellow that I had chosen was qualified. But when I had to pit my judgment against this consultant's judgment, I figured that I'd have to just go by my own judgment. And so I stuck with him. And I went away for 2 months. And by the time I got back, the business had dropped off 50%. And we had lost in 1 month $17,000 in 1 month. Now, so we called in one of the owners of the business. And the owner of the business hung around for a few days, cost us $2,500. And he came up with the recommendation that this fellow wasn't going to make it. So I decided that at that point that I thought maybe he wouldn't make it. Now, really, there are some things involved here that are basic and fundamental and some things that we need to face. I could have saved myself all kinds of headaches and, as I say, about $40,000 in losses if I had faced up to some obvious things in the first place. And so I think it's important for us to just stop and think about some of these things that when we think of this selection procedure that we have developed here, the testing and the interviewing and the sieve that we have developed, I cannot stress any more fervently than I know how important it is for us to be careful who we hire in the first place. And what a serious thing it is for us to blink our eyes at any aids that we might be able to use. And here I am. I get paid for my judgment. I get paid very well. And you know, you can get to the place where your pride, I guess, gets into your own way, and where you can close your eyes to very obvious facts. And you bring somebody in, as I did, simply because I had overcommitted myself. And then it's an awful lot easier, believe me, not to bring somebody into an organization than it is to ask somebody to leave, isn't it? My, what a burden that was for me. But Why do you need a job description? Why is it important for us to talk the way we were today? That it's clear to you what your position is, and it's clear to you what your authority is, and that it's clear to you what your responsibilities are. And I believe that the Lord simply taught me that when a man takes on a responsibility, that he had better take care of it too. Now, I had a job to do. I had to say to somebody who was a friend of mine, and a friend over a period of years, I had to say to him, you've got to go, and I didn't want to do it. Now, I've taken on the responsibility of being the president of this company, and I've taken on the responsibility of making decisions like that, and I didn't want to exercise the responsibility that I took on myself. I didn't mind collecting the salary, but I didn't want to do the work. And one of the important things, why do we need a job description? So that you have a basis for evaluating a man's work. And if we are going to succeed in crusade, we've got to have some kind of criteria for judging whether a man can succeed and whether he is succeeding and whether what he is doing is what he is expected to be doing. Now, I've been around here an awful long time, and every single summer I have people coming to me, and their complaint is the report form that we have to fill out. Every single summer I get into discussions about this. And you know who the people are who don't like it? People who don't like the report that they have to turn in. You know what people say? That report makes me feel guilty. Well, now, we oughtn't to have anything around here that makes people feel guilty, do we? Now, in order to keep people from feeling guilty, obviously the conclusion would be, if we would follow their judgment, let's not have any reports, and then nobody will feel guilty. But you know, there's another way not to feel guilty, and that is to fulfill your commitment. And the requirement to fulfill your commitment, your responsibility, you fellows who are here, you're all going to be responsible for a group of people next year. And if we're going to reach this United States in any sizable way at all, it's going to be as the people that report to you fulfill their commitment. Is that right? One of your responsibilities. This is one of the reasons why we need a job description. And this fellow's job description made it abundantly clear to me from the first month that he was not fulfilling his commitment. And what did I do? I went to all the expense and the trouble of writing a job description. And I understood that it was a gauge and a guide, and then I didn't want to use it. And that's so human, isn't it? I don't believe it's very spiritual. I don't think it's spiritual at all for me to take on the job of a president of a company and stand back and watch that company be ground into the ground and go down and down and down and down, and I stand there telling myself what a nice guy I am while that company goes down. You know, management involves getting things done through other people. And management many times involves also then making sure that you've got the right people in the right place, and that means removing the wrong people if you've got them in the wrong place. And so this matter of delegating authority is not just a matter of giving somebody a responsibility. Maybe my experience this year will illustrate the point that was made this morning, that we had better be careful who we delegate to, and we had better be careful that we delegate in small doses, and that we make sure that these people can handle a little bit of a responsibility before we give them a big one. Feed it to them in small doses, fast as they can take it, but if they can't take it, then we have to take it away. I hope you caught one of the points this morning, that you should not have a responsibility that your boss doesn't have. And it was my responsibility as well as this fellow's. And you know, by the time I removed him from that job, well, should I say when I did, everybody was relieved. One of the cruelest things that I've ever done to anybody is to allow that fellow struggle for 3 months in a job that he wasn't qualified for. And all because we all wanted a safe face. And I hated to admit that I goofed. My judgment was bad, and I didn't want to admit it. I'd like to tell you a story out of the scriptures that illustrates some of these management principles that we have been talking about. There was this fellow named Samuel, and this story is in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And Samuel was a man ordained of God and spoke for God. Like we might say, Bill Bright is ordained of God and speaks for God. I don't know, does that sound presumptuous? That's the way it went with Samuel. And Samuel was given an assignment, and he was going to go to King Saul, and he gave them a job to do. This is in the third verse. This is the assignment that Samuel gave to Saul. It's a pretty rough assignment. Go and smite Amalek, who was the king, and utterly destroy all that the Amalekites have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Now that's a pretty gory assignment. I don't understand it. But it's a pretty tough assignment. And Samuel passed this assignment along, and as you can see, it's pretty clear, and it isn't going to be very difficult to decide whether Saul had done or had not done the assignment. And so Samuel went away, and Saul went out to perform this task. Now this is what he did. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 7. Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until you come to Sur, that is over against Egypt, but he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. And he utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword, but the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good, and they would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse they destroyed utterly. Now you know, when you destroy everybody but the king, that's coming pretty close, isn't it? After all, you don't want to get too meticulous about an assignment. And they destroyed everything that was vile and everything that was no good. They kept some of the better ones. And then Samuel, who had delegated this responsibility, you might say, went to check up on how his subordinate was doing, Saul. And so when he came, Saul said unto him, when he met him, Have you ever had your boss visit you? You know, one time I took a tour with a fellow who was president of the Association of Christian Colleges, and he asked me to take a tour of Christian colleges with him. And I realized then, and I have since, as I have taken tours with mission executives, that it's awfully hard for the top man to find out what's going on. You know, of course, they were expecting us, and everywhere we went, those schools were spick and span. Everything was so nice and clean. I remember being in one school, and the fellow said, what's in there? And they rushed us off. They didn't want us to look in there. They had a schedule for us. They had all our time was taken care of, and they wanted to steer us just exactly where they wanted to steer us. They wanted us to see the part of the college that they wanted us to see. And I found this true in traveling in foreign mission fields, that, boy, when we get there, you know, the director's coming. Everything is just as nice as it can be. And it's pretty hard for the top man to find out what's going on your campus, isn't it? If you have some advance notice that he's coming. Well, Samuel, he just popped in. And so this is the way he was greeted by Saul. Blessed be thou of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. That's what he said. And he was almost right, too. And then if one of those sheep didn't bleat. And that's the way it is, boy, when you try to put on a dog. Things just don't turn out right. I remember one time when I was a student at Houghton College. I was older. I had a couple of children. We lived in, and so we had the president of the company of the college come over for supper. And you should have seen our house. Our house had never, ever been that clean. We were all uncomfortable in it. And we were supposed to act like it's always this way around here. We told the kids, three little preschool kids, what they could say and what they couldn't say. We practically had a script written for them. If any of you have preschool kids, you know better. Don't do that. Kids won't follow it. And we got them to the table, and our little daughter, Sue, who is now a college graduate, she was sitting next to the president. That was another mistake. You know, it's amazing the number of mistakes you make when you try to misrepresent yourself. You just can't think of everything. And so Sue was sitting next to the president. And in her little bitty voice, she said to the president, would you pass the salt? And, of course, we were listening to the president. We weren't paying attention to this youngest kid at the table. She tried it again. Would you pass the salt? No answer. So she pulled him by the coat sleeve, and she said, would you pass the salt or I'll knock your block off? Well, that wasn't in the script. That kid made me so mad. You see, what she was doing was interfering with my effort to mislead the president. I wonder what happened to this guy that let that sheep bleat. Now, what are you going to do when you hear a sheep bleat? You know, that's a decision that poor Samuel had to make. What would a nice man, a real nice man, do? Would he ignore the bleat? That isn't much wrong, is it? One little bleat? And if you see some live animals over here, wouldn't it just be a lot less difficult to look that way? Wouldn't it? When you go visiting on your campuses and you have somebody reporting to you and you see some little thing that's wrong and you're such a nice fellow, aren't you? And you really want to encourage these people, don't you? Now, what's the nice thing to do? What would a nice man do? Ignore that's wrong? He would, wouldn't he? I mean, you could pick out some things to compliment, but let the rest of it go. Now, you know, when I'm only 3/4 effective and you tell me that, you know, you come around to look at what I'm doing and I know that I'm not doing it right. I know it. And you go away and you say, Henry, you're doing a good job. You know what I'm going to think of you when you leave? I'm going to say to myself, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Who do you think you're kidding? If you go to see how one of your people that report to you are doing, and you don't even have enough insight to understand that they're only doing 3/4 of a job, do you think you're going to enhance your judgmental ability in their minds? Well, but when something like that happens, you've got to make up your mind what you're going to do. Are you going to face up to it or aren't you going to face up to it? You know, I walk into my restaurants and one of these cute girls, have you ever been in a Farrell restaurant? And one of these cute girls come up, stand there, and ask, what would you like? You're not supposed to do that. She's supposed to say, my name is Mary, and I am your waitress. And I'm glad you're here. Now, when I don't hear that speech, what should I do? Do you realize that one of the reasons you come back to our restaurant is because you hear somebody say, my name is Mary, and I'm your waitress tonight, and I'm glad you're here? You may not think that's why you go. But you know, we found out that when the waitresses quit saying that our business drops off. And I walk into my restaurant and stick my hand in the pocket, and I click my stopwatch, and when I take it out and my stuff isn't delivered in 8 minutes, somebody goofed. And I want to tell you, that's the difference between a profit and a loss. If I click my stopwatch off and it didn't get there, that manager is going to find out that we're not functioning right around here. No, I wouldn't do that, though, if I was a nice man, would I? You know, isn't it much more desirable to be a nice man and lose $40,000? Do you know how long you'd be a nice man? So what do you do when you see these little things going wrong? I walk into one of these places and we got hundreds of little lights, and there's one of them over there that's out. Now, a real nice man oughtn't to make anything out of a one little old light that's out when there's 100 of them, should he? I want to tell you, gentlemen, that's the difference between the kind of a business that's going to town today and the kind of a business that isn't. And I believe that that's going to be true in Campus Crusade, and we're going to succeed as we keep up this tempo and we hop to it. I travel all over the country, believe me, from conference to conference, and I don't know where to go anywhere in a country where they work you any harder than they do here. Now, what are you doing here? I can show you some easier places to be. I believe one of the reasons that you're here is because the people behind this organization mean business. They mean for you to reach the people on your campus, or they want to know why not. And that's all? That's not bad. That's good. I'll tell you, the cruelest thing that you can do is to let the people under you create a lot of bad habits. Let's take it easy. Let's back off. Let's slow down. And I think if we did, it wouldn't be very many years and we wouldn't have any housing problems around here. Well, so this is what Samuel did. He said, what meaneth the bleating of that sheep? That's a simple question, isn't it? Did I hear a sheep? How come that floor's dirty? You know, those are pesky little questions, aren't they? But you know, that's the difference between what we've got and what other people have that wonder what in the world is going on around here. What meaneth the bleating of this sheep in mine ears and the lowing of those oxen which I hear? And what did Saul say? They brought them from the Amalekites. Who? They, not me. I told them not to. That's the way people are today. You can't tell them anything, can you? The people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice them unto the Lord God, but the rest we've utterly destroyed. You see, Sam, we decided to do it in two stages. We're going to kill them. Don't worry. But we're going to sacrifice these. Well, now that's pretty good. You ought to recognize a quick wit like that, shouldn't you? And Saul said, and Samuel said, I'll tell you what the Lord said to me this night. And Saul said, say on. And Samuel said, when you were little in your own sight, and you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a journey, and he said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord? Why didn't you do it? Now that's the job of a leader. Why didn't you do it? I'll tell you, it makes a difference when you know that you're going to be checked up on, doesn't it? Have you ever been in your room, books around, clothes around, your room's a mess and there's a knock on the door? Isn't it amazing how fast you can move to get that room cleaned up? Why? Well, you're not sure who's on the other side of the door. Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord? You did evil in the sight of the Lord. And Saul said, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. Have you ever had anybody say that? Why didn't you do it? And somebody comes back to you and says, I did do it. And you say, well, he said he did it. I say he didn't. What did I tell him to do? Have you ever had that experience? That's why it's a good idea to write it down. And here's a very typical, ordinary, natural response. I did obey the voice of the Lord, and I have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and we have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and we have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. We did do what you said. Oh my, I've been through that severe so many times when I've come to a meeting of minds with somebody about what his job is, and a few months later we get into a discussion about what his job is. Did you say that? You even have to be careful what you write down. For instance, in our restaurants sometimes, we have a requirement that you keep the floor clean. Well, now that's easy enough to understand. Keep the floor clean. So we come in there and look at the floor, and I say, the floor is dirty. He said, no, it isn't dirty, it's clean. We have a requirement that you keep everything dusted. But we dusted it. But it's dusty. But we dusted it. Well, it's dusty. Now, what does it mean to be dusted? You got to pin people down. What is a clean floor? I mean, you wouldn't think so, but you do, don't you? But the people took of the spoil and the sheep and the oxen and the chief of things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice unto the Lord. We did it just the way you said. We're going to sacrifice these things. And Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? You know, some of you people, you can be standing here this summer, and you worked hard last year, didn't you? You just didn't do what you should have. But you worked hard. And you know, you run into that all kinds of places where men will sacrifice and burn themselves out on their own program. Even though it's at cross purposes with our goal. Now, don't get the idea that because you're working hard and you're working long hours and that you're being sacrificial, that that's commendable. That's only commendable if it fits with your description. Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Now here's a key verse. I want you to hear this. Anybody that's in a supervisory position has run into the resistance of his subordinates. Haven't you?
Listen to this verse. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. And I've talked to men, and so have you, as though they were bewitched, haven't you? Where they said, I won't! You aren't going to make me! And it's as though they were bewitched, and the most important thing in the world is, I'm not going to do it. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Yes. What verse is that? That's 1 Samuel 15, verse 23. And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Oh my, we can worship our own ideas, can't we? I think so clearly, don't you? And it seems so obvious that the way I see it is the way it ought to be. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, he hath also rejected you from being king. Now I'm going to close. I want to point this out before I do. That one of the wonderful privileges of a man sometimes, and this happened to Samuel, he had the privilege of crowning a king. Imagine. But you know, he also got another job. He had to take the crown away from the king. Now, which one of those was spiritual? Was one of those assignments good and the other one bad? And you know, in leadership, you have the responsibility sometimes of putting a man into a job, but you have an equally great responsibility if he isn't going to do his job. As far as your commitment is concerned to the Lord, you have the responsibility to remove him from that job. And both of those activities, the crowning and the removing, were orders from God. And in the middle was the responsibility of giving this man a clear-cut assignment, clear-cut enough so that you could judge whether he was doing his job. And here is our responsibility, that we give a man an assignment that is clear enough so that you can determine whether he's doing his job. And you obviously recognize a man's ability and you recognize a man's accomplishment. But you also recognize when he doesn't do it. In other words, you've got to call it as it is. And here's our responsibility as leaders. And if we're going to keep this vine pruned, called Campus Crusade for Christ, it's going to be as this many men in this room stop long enough and think enough to plan the work that you want the people to do who will report to you in order that we may reach this world for Christ. Isn't that great? You are a leader. And what is your job? Is to keep these fine young people that are swarming all over this place on course. In the name of the Lord, and for his glory. Thank you.